This is the Tan Talk Radio Network.
Hi, this is Patsy with a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to read a good book. Okay, well, I have a wonderful, wonderful day today ahead because I have two wonderful authors, and I always get so excited. I love historical fiction, and my first guest has written not only a great historical fiction, but he has discovered a bit of history that was not known, and I really, really love that. So I'm so happy to welcome to Joy on Paper, Stephen Hartov, and the name of his book is The Last of the Seven. Hi, Stephen.
Hi, Patsy. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it once again. Thank you so much.
Well, it's a joy to talk to you because, as I said, you know, I have over 3,000 books, and I would say 500 of them are military history. I've always been interested in military history ever since I started studying Latin in high school, and we translated Caesar's Gallic Wars. So, and I had the opportunity to visit many, many battlefields all across Europe. That's why when I got this book and I discovered that it is about an unknown troop called the X Troop, that I had not heard about, and in some ways it's very personal, so I just love this story. Tell us about it, because what I love when a book opens with a real nail biter, and you're like, what's going to happen? And this book certainly starts with a real nail biter, as we have a German, we think, officer land up in the middle of British troops. So tell us about this character that you have created.
Well, you know, we both probably grew up reading the same sorts of things. And of course, I was enthralled as a kid with military history. My mom was a refugee from Austria, and she started me reading very young. And by the time I was 10, I was reading The Guns of Navarone by Alistair MacLean. I was reading Exodus by Leon Uris. You know, I was even reading Norman Mailer stuff. I mean, that was after I'd finished reading the Hardy Boys, like all those kids did. So then, for the rest of my early adulthood, I served in various militaries. I was in the U.S. Merchant Marine. I was in the Israeli Army as a paratrooper, you know, and I just retired recently as a major from the New York Guard, and that's fed a lot of my fiction. But because of my curiosity about the lesser-known aspects of history and warfare, I came across this group of Jewish commandos who served in North Africa in the early part of World War II, 42-43, and they were called the Special Interrogation Group. That was prior to X-Troop. And these fellows, mostly Germans and Austrians, were gathered together by a British captain who trained them. He was dead fluent in German. Bertie Buck was his name. And he trained them how to camouflage themselves perfectly as Nazi soldiers. And from there, they were often running. They would infiltrate German lines and get British Special Air Service troops through the long-range desert group. They'd escort them in, and they often did it as if they had these fellows captive. So you'd have these Jews in German uniforms pretending to be Germans with British prisoners, and that's how they'd get them through the lines, and they would raid German airfields. And it was an unknown aspect of warfare history in North Africa in World War II.
Wow.
So that's how the impetus for this story came to me, and I thought, okay, these guys, you know, need to be talked about. And that's what generated, you know, my desire to write their story in fictional form. So a lot of this book is fact, but historical fiction, I weave my fictional characters through real events, and that's how The Last of the Seven came to be.
Well, it is an exciting story. And as I said, it starts with this nail biter. You don't know at first what's happening, what's going on. And then we get to know the main character. Tell us about him, because Froelich is, you've really given him a real personality so that we understand him and we want to, and we care about him. And it's throughout the book, you know, there are so many times when we're just really a nail, when they talk about a nail biter, in your book, you have some real nail biters where we really get tense with the action.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I was going for that. And, you know, when somebody really appreciates the, you know, the work that you did, the book took me quite a few years to write. So when somebody gets it and somebody of your caliber gets it, it's really great. So I appreciate that. Well, Froelich, Bernard Froelich, is actually based on my mother's brother, who came here from Austria by himself, came to the States by himself, lost most of the family in the Holocaust, learned English, turned around, joined the American Army, went ashore a few days after D-Day in France, and fought all the way across Europe under Patton. So a lot of Froelich's personality and his background and his hometown, all the stuff that's in the book about his sister and his hometown is all based on my uncle and my mother and their parents. So he's a very real character to me. Now, of course, I imbued him with my own feelings about and struggles as a you know, paratrooper and as a soldier myself. I mean, that's where you get the, you know, if you haven't really done something like that, it's very difficult to write about it accurately. It's why I always say to people when I'm on a book tour or something, they ask me what kind of research I do, and I say, which is true, I never write about some place that I haven't gone to. Because you can't smell it or taste it unless you've been there. I mean, there are writers who have to write using Google research because they can't go somewhere, but it's a primary thing for me. And it's the same with my characters. I usually write from a point of view of something that I've experienced myself so that it will seem very real. And that's why that opening, you know, I was in the desert for a long time as a soldier. And that's why that opening sequence, I think, seems so real to you.
I like to say it plays so well because as I was reading this book, I saw it as a film in my head. And I think that comes from you have a background in theater. And so your writing, you're so cinematic, so, you know, playwright style that there's you really, really take us into the story. And I, as I said, I saw it as a film in my head, and I'm hoping that one day somebody will make a film of it because it is wonderful. And particularly, I love, as I think I mentioned to you once, that I really, really love Sicily. I spent quite a bit of time in Sicily. I love Sicily. And when you get to Sicily, you really write about Sicily. It's fantastic.
Two things that you just mentioned, which might be interesting to some listeners, is yeah, you're right. I actually went to theater school. I thought that's what I was going to do. And when I got out of the army, I was no longer interested in performing myself. I wanted to write. But those 4 years of theater school really informed the way I structure a book, how I visualize it, the way you do also, very cinematically. And it was very helpful with dialogue. It's always been helpful for me in creating dialogue, having that education. So then the other thing is Sicily. So you understand exactly what I was talking about before. If you've been to Sicily and somebody writes about Sicily who hasn't been there, you're going to know. And that's why I go to the places that I'm going to write about. So, you know, we're both in love with this place. And I hope that it comes out in the pages how I felt about Sicily.
Then
I place the characters into that environment.
And of course, tell us about the monastery that, you know, you it's always so wonderful when you're writing a story. It takes over your whole being. You're just immersed in it, and you have an idea. And then, of course, as I said, in Sicily is a special place. And when I think back to the time that I was there and I had the opportunity to actually, in those years, I could still talk to people who lived through World War II. You know, older people in the villages, and they are all so warm and friendly, and you could sit all day just chatting with them. But they would talk about their memories of that time. So tell us a little bit about how you discovered this monastery.
Well, this is, yeah, Sicily is a magical place. And there are still a few elderly people who remember the war. And when you go to Sicily, as you know, you're still passing German machine gun bunkers. You see in Gela, there are murals on the wall about Operation Husky that show American paratroopers coming. I mean, the Sicilians haven't forgotten. But I decided that the central piece of this drama was going to take place in Sicily. I don't know why. Sometimes these things just come to you, and that it was going to take place in a field hospital in a monastery. Why? I don't know. But that's what popped into my mind. And I picked this monastery in Agrigento off the net. I just looked up, you know, beautiful classic monasteries in Sicily. I picked Santo Spirito, this monastery. And then after structuring the book, I knew I had to go there and actually feel it, look at it, see it. And it was going to be a field hospital in my story. And I went there. I stayed there because they have a B&B. I had a guide who was a young sister, a nun. And on the second day, standing there in this beautiful monastery, I asked her, I said, Sister Mary Catherine, I think was her name. I said, what happened here during World War II? And she says, it was a field hospital. And I was just...
It gives you the chills.
Yeah, she said, yes, it was an American and British field hospital. The nave was bombed by the Germans. They used the back part of the courtyard, and I was just, I knew I was in the right place. So I stayed there for 10 days, and I wrote basically all my notes for the middle part of the book right there in Agrigento and Sculiana, and that's why... The texture of it, I think, feels real to the reader because it felt real to me.
It does. It does. I, as you said, it's the middle part of the book. And when I got to that part, I was enthralled with it and with your writing and being able to see it in my head. And as I said, I was right from the beginning, actually from the first scene, I was thinking of it as a film. And I'm sometimes when I do that, I just sort of have to pinch myself and say, it's not a film yet, but it's going to be one day.
I hope so. I hope you're right. As they say, from your mouth to God's ears, I hope somebody recognizes that it would make a good film. But, you know, that's up to the gods of Hollywood. You know how these things happen. Sometimes they happen, sometimes they don't.
I know. I've got three of them in turnaround. One of these days.
There you go.
You never know. But this is exactly the kind of film. There's so much to it. I think the humanity of it, the understanding of that you've been to war, you understand what it means, and you understand, and I think that comes through the pain. I mean, there's a lot of pain in this book, you know, from the battle scenes, but there's also, I think, a big heart, and there's an underlying theme of, well, I don't know, things could be better, but definitely things could be worse, but you know, there's that theme I think that you have there of really that there is a goodness in mankind if we look for it.
That's my theme, Patsy. I mean, I licensed a photograph, a Getty photograph, for my website, and I sort of use it as a theme. And it's a picture of an elderly Sicilian woman kissing a 19-year-old GI after the liberation of Sicily. And it means It's a Holton Deutsch photograph, and it's gorgeous. It's on my website if anybody wants to look. It's on the homepage of stephenharson.com. And my I write under there, I don't write war stories. I write stories about people that happen to take place during times of war. And that's my, you know, I'm not about the gunfire. I'm about between the gunfire or after the gunfire or what people are feeling, whether they're combatants or witnesses. And I think that's much more interesting than the action, although, of course, the action feeds those emotions. So if you get that balance right, you've got more than a war book. You've got sort of a universal story of the human condition and soul and struggle.
Well, I think The Last of the Seven is a fantastic novel, and one that I hope that people will get, read it. And one of the things is this enormous, you know, the bravery of these people to go back, you know, into this fight when they were out of it. They didn't have to go back. You know, they were these people who had lost so much already, and they go back to fight and to get revenge. But you know, that's one of the things that I think is so important, that you have that in your book.
Well, yes. I mean, the bravery was incomparable. The danger to these young men was at least double, if not triple. I mean, they were all Jews, so if they got caught by the Germans, they knew they were going to die. And if they got caught by the Germans while wearing German uniforms, they were going to die quickly and not well.
Yeah,
so
maybe not quick enough. They would have been tortured. They would have been the horrific death that they would have suffered if they had been caught in German uniform. So they were so brave, so very brave. And I think that by bringing out this Troop X and getting people really to understand it, to appreciate it, it also reflects on you and what you've done in your service, both to America and to Israel. And, you know, I don't know. I think a few years ago, we would not have thought that there would be a war in the Ukraine. I don't think anybody would predict a land war in the Ukraine. So
correct.
There is this interest now, I think, in understanding what's happening and what happens to the fighters, and as you said, the people before and after a battle. So there's a lot in your book that is so relevant to today as well as to World War II.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I think people are becoming, you know, we haven't had a conflict like that in Europe since in a long, 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 long time. And it does reflect back on the European and East European landmass and how volatile it is. And when you're living in an area that is that volatile and can erupt into a shooting war so quickly, you begin to understand, and a lot of our young people look at this war and then they understand, oh, that's what World War II must have been like. So, you know, time passes very, very quickly, but it doesn't change much.
No.
So I think you're right. I think that, you know, writing a historical fiction about some of these great struggles is relevant, always relevant to what's going on somewhere in the world, and that's why people identify with it or seem to, yes.
Definitely. Now, I like that you mentioned in the beginning that you were reading at 10 years old, you were reading, you know, and as I was, of course, I remember I was must have been the same age when I read Exodus and Mila 18. I remember that book. So I went through a period there where I would eat, and my mother almost went crazy, I think for about 2.5 weeks while I was reading that book and several other books, all I wanted was a watery soup made with potato skins. and I did it. I just I just had to know what it was like. And
oh my Lord, we had very similar childhoods, and our mothers must have suffered equally.
I think so. And because later on, I had the opportunity to be at the 50th anniversary of the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising. And,
oh, wow.
And I was there, and I remembered how that book had, in a way, it changed my life. Because after that, I understood. And with my, I think with that, just eating this watery potato skin soup, I felt it, and it changed my life. And books can do that, and that's why I am so really sad that in America, so many young people can only read at an eighth grade level, and I just don't understand it, because having books will change your life.
Oh, Exodus changed mine. And I wasn't always happy about it. I mean, when I read it two or three times when I was of that age, about 13. And then 10 years later, I was an Israeli paratrooper, which was the most brutal experience I'd ever had. And Leon Uris showed up at the King David Hotel in Jerusalem to work on another book, and I wanted to go kill him. But I got over that, you know. So, books can change your life. And it is a terrible shame that, I mean, the whole reading culture now has been reduced to, you know, quick bites, and you open a magazine article online, and the first thing it does is tell you how much time it's going to take you to read it, as if that's the most important thing, you know? And I wish we could re-imbue our younger people with the love of reading. There will always be a certain percentage who do love to read, but I sort of feel when I talk to my younger peers that the numbers of young folks who will sit down and have the patience to read a good a novel is dwindling. It's definitely dwindling. I don't know how we're going to turn that around, if ever.
And as you mentioned Exodus, it changed my life, because I was in one of the first groups of American volunteers after the Yom Kippur War. I got up, you know, I was in California, in Berkeley, and I just left. I went to Israel after the war.
Wow.
And that was all because of Exodus. Just 100%.
Yeah, totally.
That was in my, you know, and I was very young, but that was part of me. And so... Oh, it's funny. Yes, we did have, I think, very similar mothers.
Very similar experiences. I was there too.
Yeah.
And I was so influenced by that book and other stories about Israel and so forth that I quit college.
Me too.
In the middle.
Me too.
You too?
Yes.
I went and joined. I was broke, so I couldn't get to the Middle East.
Me
except
too.
One way, and that was by joining the Merchant Marine until I could get close enough to jump ship. So that's how I got there.
And
I
didn't have to pay for my flight because I was a volunteer. They paid for volunteers to go, and I was there.
There you go.
But I didn't have any money to get out of there. So that's, It was so funny. It's, yes, very, very similar. Well, I hope that, and there is a great generation, and we have of a lot of people, and I'm working with a lot of different groups who do love to read, and I know that they will love this book, The Last of the Seven by Stephen Hartov. And then when they get through with that, you have some other just great books. And I want to tell people, you've probably seen Stephen. He's been on CNN and Fox and CNBC. They ask him questions about different, I think, a lot of terrorist events, right?
Yeah, that when they have me on, it's usually in reference to some sort of military specialty or counterterrorism or my experiences overseas or in Afghanistan or whatever. But my real love is writing fiction. I've written a lot of nonfiction and successfully and so forth. But this is the stuff we really, when you can really, you know, go to town with your themes and your characters. So.
And you can touch people's hearts.
Yeah, I do some TV, but I love the.
And the important thing, you can touch people's hearts and minds.
Right,
and,
exactly.
And get
exactly.
them to think about things as Leon Uris did for us, you know? So
exactly, exactly.
Yeah, so you're the next generation. A wonderful, wonderful book. Thank you so much for being on Joy on Paper. It's been a joy to talk to you. And you know what we'll do is we'll have you back and we'll talk about some of your other books. And also the influence of studying theater in your entire, you know, oeuvre, how that has affected your writing, okay?
Patsy, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I want to thank you on behalf of all writers who've experienced your program and readers who listen to you, that this is a rare and wonderful thing you do, and bless you for it. I really appreciate it. Look forward to being on again.
Okay, so it's Stephen Hartov. His website is, it's just stephenhartov.com, right?
Correct.
Okay, and everybody get this book. It's a great read, and get it, and then when the film comes out, you'll be able to say, I read the book. Okay? Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye.
Bye-bye now.
All right. We're going to play a book buzz from Devon Miller, and then I'm going to be back in a few minutes.
Hey everyone, it's Devon Miller, author and illustrator of the Mr. Tickety Talk Lock children's book series, reporting for Joy on Paper with the latest on children's book buzz. Do you want to have a playtime adventure? Why not have it with chicken? Or should I say, con pollo? Meet Pollo, a friendly chicken who wants to play all day. Pollo is the character from the book Con Pollo, a bilingual playtime adventure. The book was written by host of The Tonight Show Jimmy Fallon alongside Jennifer Lopez. The book was illustrated by Andrea Campos. A New York Times bestseller, this was Jennifer Lopez's first children's book and is dedicated to Jimmy Fallon's high school Spanish teachers. Con Pollo, a bilingual playtime adventure, serves as an introduction to basic Spanish vocabulary to young readers as you decide what fun to have with your new friend, Pollo. The idea of the book came from Jimmy Fallon and Jennifer Lopez wanting to partner up and do something together. After various ideas, they settled on writing a children's book together. During the pandemic, people were getting chickens as pets, which sparked the idea for a book with chickens. And of course, the design of Pollo came from the illustrator Andrea Campos, who couldn't believe she was offered to illustrate the book. When Andrea was on The Tonight Show with Jimmy Fallon, Jimmy gifted her a stuffed Pollo plush. If you ever get your own plush of Pollo, maybe you could continue to listen to Joy on Paper, con Pollo. This is Devon Miller reporting for Joy on Paper. For more book buzz involving children's books and authors, head on over to radio-joyonpaper.com and click on Devon Miller's Book Buzzes. I think it's about time that I buzz out now.
This is the TAN Talk Radio Network.
Are you ready to eliminate your home energy bill? Well, get ready to harness the sun. Go EHS, Effective Solar Solutions, by Efficient Home Services. With no upfront costs, you can save money on your utility bill and even eliminate your electric bill altogether with EHS Solar. Call EHS, the number one solar installer nationwide. We know how to customize your home. EHS handles every project in-house with no subcontractors. Remember, no upfront costs, tax breaks, and the best company in the business, Efficient Home Services. Schedule an appointment today at 727-353-3757. Visit our website and download your free buyer's guide to going solar at www.goehs.com. Go solar, go savings, go EHS. Call 727-353-3757 today to talk to our experts.
Are you an author, an artist, an inventor? Then you need to protect your valuable intellectual property. You need Larson & Larson. We have the experience and knowledge to help you with all of your legal needs, from processing trademark, copyright, or patent applications to negotiating licensing agreements and handling litigation. The attorneys at Larson & Larson in Largo, Florida can help protect you. Call us today for a no-cost consultation at 727-546-0660 or visit our website at LarsonPatentLaw.com.
Do you dread being called on to speak at meetings or family functions? Have you envied those who can sway an audience with well-chosen words? Do you know that people who speak well earn more money, earn more recording careers? Gain the confidence to master any speaking situation. Toastmasters will allow you to find your voice. Go to toastmasters.org to locate the club nearest you.
This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
Patsy with a Z, and I am back with my next guest, Dan Flanagan, and the name of his book is On Lonesome Roads, and it is book three in his Peter O'Keefe series. Hi, Dan.
Hello.
Okay, well, I always love to talk to lawyers. I spend half my life talking to lawyers. And why is it? I hate to say this.
Some would say that's because you've done something wrong in a past life.
Well, I don't know. I did some stupid things in the current one, I guess, is more like it. But I have, actually, I have paid for a Porsche for one lawyer. So, but I'm not jealous. I'm not jealous that not only are you a lawyer, now you're going to make a little fortune here on this wonderful series, because I think it's great. Peter O'Keefe is an unusual private investigator, and you have had yourself a rather unusual career as a finance, banking, and bankruptcy lawyer, and you've put it into your stories where we're talking about the 1980s, and wow, it's quite an idea that you came out with the entire story about Peter O'Keefe. So tell us about him.
This begins in 1986. He's in his mid-30s by then. He's a Vietnam veteran with some significant scars from that experience. He's also had way too much involvement with alcohol and cocaine, but he's and his best childhood friend, a lawyer named Michael Harrigan, kind of picked him up out of the gutter and said, "I'm going to make a private detective out of you. See if you can make something out of your life." And so he's struggling, as he puts it, to make himself into a useful person here, and I can't help himself but getting into some pretty serious adventures along his way.
And of course, we're talking in the 80s, in that period of time. I don't know that we can limit greed and corruption to that period, so it's spilled over it. But you certainly grasp it and make the most of it.
Thanks. And this period starts in 86, but my goal for this series is to take these characters, O'Keefe and the people in his orbit, and the ones that get added in the future, and maybe some that sort of take over some of the narratives and so on, and really write a history of our time, sort of get up as close to the present day as I can through this series. So we've only begun, although the third book I've only managed to get to 1988, but I intend to keep going.
Well, I think it's a great idea, because you have plenty of stories along the way. But yes. Looking back at 88, well, where do we start here? There's so much. One thing I have to right away say, you know, when people learn to understand Peter and you start to care about him, and we have the situation where he's been gone through a bombing himself, which you can explain, but I can't tell you how much I was so happy that he found a nice house. You know, this is the woman in me.
That's great.
I was worried about him, and I so wanted him to have a nice place to live. So I tell you, so that's why I want to tell people that this book, you know, you have corruption and you have crime, but it also, you have a lot of heart in this book. So I think all women will enjoy it. You have his daughter. So this makes it, this is not a book just for men. These are books, really, women will love these books too.
I am very happy to hear you say that. And unfortunately, I forgot to emphasize, let's call it the domestic aspects of his life. But he is divorced, although you can see that relationship perhaps getting restored someday. But he has an 11-year-old in the latest book, daughter, and they have a significant relationship, and the daughter even has her own pretty substantial subplot in this new book. So I don't know how I'm going to get women to read these books, but I sure hope they do. I just had a local little book club meeting with all women who probably haven't read a mystery, if they ever read one in their lives, it wasn't recent, and it seemed like they enjoyed it. So I will tell you that
C.J. Box has been on my program many times, and he also included in his thrillers, and he included from the beginning his wife and one of his daughters, and she's grown up through the series as he's been going now for quite a few years. And she's grown up. We've watched her grow up, and women readers flock to these books. The stories are good. I mean, all women, you know, a lot of women, of course, read cozy mysteries, but a lot of women love. I mean, that's why, you know, not only men read Lee Child. It is women, too. And so the thing is, it is when I read this and when I, you know, got to know Peter and care about Peter, as you said, he had a rough life. He wasn't exactly the best, you know, role model to begin with. But with the wife, the ex-wife now, and of course Kelly, who you can carry through until she's 30 years old, you have a series that can keep going, you know, and she'll have grandchildren. So C.J. Box has done it. Half of his readers are women. So you can do it too, because you write in a way that is strong, yet with this kind of gentle portions of it that will warm women's hearts. They'll love this book.
I appreciate that. I'll keep at it.
Yeah, mention it, you know, in your promos too, because this is a wonderful story.
Super.
Okay. So I've given you some great advice, and if C.J. Box can do it, so can Dan Flanagan.
Yeah, and he has to overcome even the fish and game thing.
Yeah,
the wilderness.
He does. That's not easy, because some women don't like that at all. Now, of course, I've been fishing since I was 2 years old, so I love that part of his book. But half of his readers are women, and the same thing. You market this to women like crazy, because it is that. You have these heartwarming parts. I like Kelly very much. But now let's get to some of the nitty-gritty part. But women like it too. As I said, if they read Lee Child, they'll read this, because he bashes everybody's head against the car. So tell us about the basic storyline here. Who's corrupt in this story? A lot of people.
Yes, the we start with the first in the series, Mink Eyes, which it is a mink farm Ponzi scam in a place, let's call it like the Missouri Ozarks, and he investigates that, and that leads him into all kinds of places. But he gets in trouble with the mafia in that book. And the next two, a lot of them, not all of them, are sort of him getting in deeper trouble and then extracting himself or trying to extract himself from it. In the second book, The Big Tilt, one of his other childhood buddies is a candidate for mayor and a corrupt real estate developer kind of guy who's also committed a date rape and a resulting pregnancy in his youth that he's gotten away with, but now is having to face a little bit of blackmail for it. And one of the themes is really that the decline of the traditional mafia in these years, everything from the RICO prosecutions and the extensive wiretapping, but much of it because of all the things that they provided to the world that the world wanted, the world decided to legalize. What would the mafia be without gambling? And all of a sudden you have in the 80s and 90s a legalization of gambling, you know, with the lotteries and so on. So I don't know if that speaks exactly to what you were looking for, but that's the main theme of these that runs through all three books.
Well, of course, you've seen it from the lawyer's perspective. You had to deal with a lot of criminals and scams and.
And in the second book, Big Tilt, there's a whole trial that arises out of the a trial of his buddy Harrigan, who himself gets in trouble, that arises out of the savings and loan scandal which just dominated the 80s and the financial, and the early 90s and the financial, damn near broke the country.
Well, when you get to 2008, I can be your technical advisor because. We had a mess here in Florida, I can tell you. Oh, that was quite a mess. But in the new book, On Lonesome Roads, tell us about what is happening. What you know, we have here that Peter's recovering. Mention what happened to him.
Yeah, he. Was the victim in the previous book of a car bomb. And everyone, including him for a time, or not everyone, or everyone other than him and maybe a couple of people in the police force that knew better, assumed that it was the local mafia that did that to him. But and that made his life impossible because nobody wanted to be around him, be the potential target of the next attack. His former wife would only let him see his daughter, rightfully so, with a police or a security guard, and in that kind of environment. So, but he thinks that it was another source who was trying to kill him with that bomb. So he sets out on sort of a dual mission. One, if it was the mafia, he wants to negotiate a deal with them. So he ends up hooking up with the big mafia chief who's died recently in prison, his daughter, who's become sort of co-head of the local mafia. And then on the other side, he's investigating the other strand of what he thinks really happened, which the source of that is in a local strip club with a bunch of low-life characters in that he's run into. And meanwhile, Kelly, his daughter, is facing the possibility of a new stepfather, which she doesn't want any part of and really suspects that he's a bad guy. And so she starts her own sort of Nancy Drew-like investigation, although just think of an 11-year-old in the 80s and trying to be in reality, not in some kind of fantasy world, of trying to figure out the background of somebody she doesn't think is on the up and up. And so those are the strands of this story in the current book.
Well, that's why it's so interesting, and I love Kelly's involvement. I love that. I love that storyline, and that's what makes the book fascinating. You have layers to the story, so it's not just one story. There's parallel stories that make the book a fun read. I think you've done a terrific job, and I look forward, because I know that we have plenty of corruption as we go along. When you get to the some of the things that happened in 2008, I am already looking forward to that. Between the stock market and the scams and the terrible things that went on here in Florida. You have lots of material. You're a great writer. It's really, of course, so many great lawyers have become great novelists because you have a natural way with language, and so you're a fine writer, and I really enjoy it. And Dan, I want to thank you for being on Joy on Paper today, because I think it's going to be a great series, and just as eventually, once there were enough books, they turned Jack Reacher into a television series. Once you have enough books so that they can start looking at you, I think you could get a television series out of this, because I like him. I just like Peter O'Keefe. And I think once you have that strong character and, as you said, all the people around it, that you've given really strong characters for him to work with, you have a winner here.
Well, thank you very much. That inspires me to get back to work on the next one.
That's it. You have to keep going, because it's something that you have to build up. But you'll get it. I think you'll get it, because this is a character that I would like to see on television. And so I want to, again, thank you. What's your website so people can go?
It's just Dan Flanagan Books.
Okay, Dan Flanagan.
And the odd part is Flanagan spelled in a
with an I.
Way. It's Flanagan.
Yeah, yeah, you
put, Dan Flanagan Books.
You put the I in Flanagan.
Yeah, well, actually, that's a story in itself. We think they made a mistake when they arrived at Ellis Island. It should have been an A, but whatever.
Well, probably they did. They made a heck of a mistake with my grandfather's name. I won't even tell you what they... It was pretty horrific. We had years and years to overcome that one. It's called On Lonesome Roads. It's a great read, and then when you read this one, get mink eyes. By the way, minks used to always scare me. We had a mink ranch. They had a mink ranch not far from us, and they used to terrorize us kids. It was like a thing. If the minks escape, they're going to eat you. So as a kid, we were terrified of the idea of a mink. But it's a great book, and so you have three wonderful books here: Mink Eyes, Big Tilt, and the newest book is On Lonesome Road. And everybody, you will really, really, and all you women out there, you will like Peter O'Keefe. If you like Reacher, you're going to like Peter O'Keefe. That's the way to work it. When you talk to people, if you say, if you like Reacher, you like Peter O'Keefe. Okay?
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Appreciate that.
Okay. Bye-bye now. Bye, Dan. It's great talking to you.
Bye.
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 Okay, yeah, you know, that's what I like. I just like, as I was saying, with C.J. Box, I mean, I love his stories. I love his action. All of that. And I like all the hunting part, and I like especially when he talks about fishing. But women like action, and I can tell you now with the new Jack Reacher, streaming Jack Reacher, yeah, really like him. Everybody, Tom Cruise is cute, but the new Jack Reacher is like one hunk of a guy. They're filming it right now. They're filming it up in Toronto. Oh, wow. Oh, wow. I wish I could go up there and see them filming it because the second season, they're filming right now. And I was so grateful that Lee Child was here on Joy on Paper in time for his birthday so we could talk to him. And I know he's excited. And finally, he has the Lee Child of his dreams. The Jack Reacher of his dreams, because probably when he set it up, when he first started, Lee himself is 6'5" with blue eyes, but he never bulked himself up like the new guy, and it's a wonderful series. So, but definitely get this book. I really enjoy it, and of course Stephen Hartov, that, you know, when you have a mystery like that, nobody knew about, you know. Nobody had heard about it. Troop X, and that's by Stephen Hartov, and that is a wonderful book, and that's the last of the seven. So, you got two great books today. It's so wonderful. Oh, and special thanks to all of you people who are doing NaNoWriMo. I love getting your emails. Oh, I'm so proud of you. I have at least seven of you are doing NaNoWriMo, and some of you have kept up and are doing your every day you're doing your pages. A few of you are a little behind, but you can catch up. You have the whole month of November. You don't have to finish your 50,000 words until the end of November. And I'm so very proud of you and so grateful for your emails. Keep it up. Keep it up. You will be proud of yourself at the end. You will have an entire novel in 1 month. And then after that, you can go back and fix it and revise it and all that fun stuff that makes writing a real joy. But meanwhile, you've accomplished something. You've made a decision that you're going to finally write the book of your dreams, and you are doing it. So I'm really grateful. Keep those emails coming. I want to hear. And if any of you in the end want to come on the program, I would love to talk to you and see, you know, how you've done it. And just I'm just so proud to know all of you who have made that decision. Because remember what I always tell you. One of the joys of life is to see your words on paper, or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I am hoping for Carol J. Perry. And by the way, her new book is out. It's called High Spirits. It has a Christmas theme. It's perfect for reading right now, and you can get that. And remember, Thanksgiving is Nat Geo Gift Day. So if you're going to visit anyone on Thanksgiving, make sure that you bring them a Nat Geo book, because there is a perfect Nat Geo book for everyone in your family. And it is a wonderful, wonderful conversation piece while you're waiting for the turkey and waiting for the game and in between the parade. This is, you put out a Nat Geo book and the entire family can read it and talk about it and have a wonderful, heartwarming conversation. Anyway, meanwhile, say something nice to somebody. I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room because I'm running out of time. He saluted me. And he has to salute me because I should have been a general. I would have been such a great general.
WTAN Clearwater.
FM 106.1.
WDCF Dade City.
FM 106.1.